Boca Raton's role in World War II in a high school baseball tournament almost as big as the World Series. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. WLRN-TV will be airing a new documentary next week that looks at Boca Raton's important role in helping win World War II. It all has to do with the creation of a new and more powerful radar. We'll hear more about that story. Every year, Japanese baseball fans are engrossed in a tournament called Koishen. It's a high school baseball tournament. We'll talk to the director of a documentary that dives deep into this cultural phenomenon that focuses on respect and honor. We'll start things off, though, with a look at the Riviera Beach City Council and a Palm Beach Post story that looks at the way city leaders are spending taxpayer dollars. We'll even hear from the mayor. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Riviera Beach is caught up in a lot of controversy right now. WPTV in Palm Beach County has a timeline of the hiring and firing of city manager Jonathan Evans. There have been a lot of questions as to why he was fired after barely 6 months on the job. And that's just the beginning. An investigation by the Palm Beach Post looks at many of the expenditures by council members over a period of time, and they found that tax dollars have been spent on high-end hotels, trips to China, Spain, Hawaii, the Bahamas, and rental cars, probably when they weren't needed. Riviera Beach struggles with poverty. There's a lawsuit right now against the city, and some people want a recall on some of the council members. We're joined now by the mayor of Riviera Beach, Thomas Masters, and by Tony Doris, the reporter who covered the story for the Palm Beach Post. I appreciate both of you joining us today. Tony, let me start with you. How are you tipped off to the council's expenditures and the story about the city manager being fired?
Well, actually, I was asked to take a look at Riviera Beach after the hurricane to see how things were going there. And I checked in and happened to meet the city manager, and it was great. He showed me upstairs in his office where he'd been sleeping during the hurricane to take care of things, and spoke to him and then left. And then 2 days later, I got a call from somebody, a reader out there, saying, hey, you know, the city manager was just fired. And so I thought, what? He seemed like he was pretty much on the ball to me, a little bit that I knew of him. And so I started looking into things, and I started hearing about expenditures and following the document trail.
And then when we look at these expenditures, so what you had pointed out in your story is that you had followed a number of different council members and even the mayor who had taken trips, trips to all kinds of conferences, not just throughout the country, but also outside of the country. And you had listed the cost of these trips and the stays at these very, very nice, expensive hotels.
Well, what I did was when I heard that the city council members had credit cards, and until recently each one had two credit cards, and that they had travel allowances of $10,000 from the city and another $7,500 a year they could spend for the city's community redevelopment agency, $17,500 per person for each individual to travel per year. So I decided to ask for all their credit card expense forms, which are public records, and all their travel vouchers and the backup for that. And you know, I put that together with 30 years of covering municipalities, and it really stuck out as something extraordinary.
Was there anything, though, that was illegal about this? I mean, look, when you look at the numbers, it may come off looking kind of bad. You know, you had one council member who had stayed at the Marriott Orlando World Hotel, $1,700, stayed at the Marriott Wardman Park in Washington, D.C., another almost $1,600. All right, that's a lot, but is there anything illegal?
No, and the story did not say that there is. It's just a matter of balance. You've got a poor city or a city with you know, a third of the residents living in poverty. A lot of things going wrong that need to be addressed, and so it kind of went against the grain to see you know, major expenses and council members all going to the same conference and spending $10,000 total, saddling the taxpayers with that for you know, educational conferences like Florida League of Cities and National League of Cities, which are good, but you know, other cities send one representative to a conference, or maybe two, or once in a while, others will go. But you know, they were piling on; they're taking their aides to conferences, you know, it was that kind of thing that kind of made the eyebrows go up.
I'll ask you about the AIDS here in just a moment. Let me bring in Riviera Beach Mayor Thomas Masters. Mr. Masters, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Look, you had the Palm Beach Post story. You had WPTV's covered this story, again, mostly about your city manager being fired. But look, how do you respond to that? How do you respond to the fact that you've had people at city meetings angry? They want answers.
Well, let me just digress for one moment and say I'm very disappointed that L.A. Dodgers lost the World Series because I'm a Dodgers fan coming from L.A., but I'm glad Houston won. Secondly, hello, Tony. How are you today?
I'm fine. The Houston Astros are in West Palm Beach, by the way, so you can root for them now.
So we're with the Astros. Well, I've always said from day one it was an unjust firing of one of the best city managers we ever had. It wasn't on the agenda. It was late at night. It was when everyone was gone, just about. We didn't have at the location we were located in. We didn't have the TV rolling. There wasn't any internet. And he was fired for with cause, which was the cause that the young man stated was misfeasance. And when asked what that was and what misfeasance did they have, and basically they couldn't give us an answer. We don't have an answer as of today. What was the misfeasance? It was motion seconded and then passed by three people. And then we were told that we would be told at the next meeting. And the next meeting came, and then people lawyered up, and the lawyer said that they couldn't talk about it because of there were lawsuits pending. And then another meeting later, or maybe two meetings later, the lawyer basically said, "Yeah, it was. You said it was with cause. However, it needs to be changed to without cause."
Well, Mayor Masters, why do you think he was fired? Why do you think Jonathan Evans was fired after barely 6 months on the job?
Well, I don't know, honestly, but I can tell you that one of the council people recently stated several reasons that they problems that they had. They said something about a fire tax, something about the beach erosion on Singer Island, et cetera. But all of these, that was not misfeasance. City managers are hired to give direction. They're hired to give us options. And then when the council looks at all the options, it's not the city manager that chooses it's not the city manager that chooses the option. It's the council.
All right, if I may.
Mr. Evans was doing his job.
If I may, Tony, sure. Tony Doris. Look, there's reading into the story a little bit. Was Jonathan Evans pointing out to the council members about their expenditures and how they were using the money that had anything to do with his firing?
It appears so. I mean, as the mayor says, the three council members who voted to fire him refused to say exactly, other than misfeasance or he wasn't doing things he was supposed to do, but you never heard them say any of those things he was supposed to be doing during a council meeting. So what was it? But clearly the city manager behind the scenes was giving them a little bit of pushback when they would submit their vouchers. One councilwoman put in a voucher. She wanted $285 for the city to pay for her alumni dues at her college. You know, other people were doing things like buying a $45 pair of Darth Vader boots for a Halloween event and putting it on the city tab. And another one was wanted to do xeriscape projects and use city money for that in her district, but it was on private property. So you would see emails from the city manager saying very politely and very diplomatically, "Ma'am, you know, this is private property. We have legal issues with this. You can't use city money for that." And one of the city council members did say from the dais that she resented being told that she couldn't use city money to repair a private individual's driveway.
Let me come back.
She didn't like getting that.
Mayor Masters, let me come back. Again, we were talking about the expenditures as one of the issues. And look, they pointed out in the story how different council members had been taking trips. And these were trips to conferences, mayor's conferences, and so forth. You'd taken some trips. You've taken trips to China, the Bahamas, Haiti. Why? What were these trips about?
First of all, let's deal with China. 40% of the U.S. debt is owed to China, 40%. 27% of the student population at Suncoast is of Asian descent. the largest in the Palm Beach County.
Okay,
it's not
but
the state.
Mayor, why do
no,
you...
No, I'm telling you why. We have a... There's some connections there with Riviera Beach and China. We have a port, a world port. We have a first-class marina. China builds most of the mega yachts in the world. So we took a trip to China. I did, along with the CRA representative. We wanted to sit down with Chinese investors. We wanted to tell our story about Riviera Beach, why and how they could come here and invest in our city, because we know that China goes all over the world. They have invested in Haiti. They have invested in several cities in Africa. And we wanted to tell our story. And if you go to the Palm Beach Post and click on the presentation that I gave to the Chinese investors and to others, you would see it was worth every dime. And I'm being told that the Chinese, the 15 Chinese investors will be coming to Riviera Beach late January or February to visit our city and look at the great investment possibilities. We have the marina, the Ocean Mall, we have property. Tourism is on the map, as well as what China can bring to Riviera Beach.
All of these trips,
global city.
So all of these trips, there's a purpose. It's because you're looking for an opportunity, one, probably to network, but also to find investment to come back to the city. When you look at your
Absolutely.
Other...
There were two trips to China.
Okay, when you look at your other trips to Bahamas, Haiti was for relief efforts. I'll ask you about that in a minute. Bahamas, New York... again,
well, let's talk about the Bahamas. We are a sister city to Freeport, Bahamas. We have been for about 6-7 years. And the reason why we are a sister city to Freeport, because at our port, we have the cruise ship that goes between Riviera Beach and Freeport 2 or 3 times a week. So it's just a natural fit. You have Bahamians coming over. You have Americans going over. And we have established a relationship for tourism both ways, and also see how we could help the Bahamian people and how the Bahamas can help us in some of the things that we're trying to accomplish. So we have this relationship, sister city relationship with Freeport, Bahamas, and we're very proud of it. They brought 35 young people over here for basketball, for sport, culture events. So that's what the Bahamas a connection is all about, is promoting our sister city relationship.
Can all of these trips that you and the other council members have taken, can you show a benefit to the city of Riviera Beach?
Absolutely.
Tony Doris, you've heard from other council members?
And I'm talking about me.
Okay, about you. All right, Tony Doris, you've spoken to other council members. How do they...
Yeah.
Defend the trips. And again, not just the trips, but looking at the expenditures of the hotels that are usually over $1,000. By the way, how many nights are they spending in those hotels?
Three nights.
And the bill goes up to $1,700, $1,500,
$1,600? I guess so. I mean, the mayor stayed in New York City, and it was, I think, $1,500, something like that for him.
I was there for five days. Exactly.
All right. I mean... Okay,
so
this is the point I want to make.
Well,
most of these trips at the hotels are where the conferences are being held, most of them.
You don't always have to, but Mayor, you don't always have to stay at the same hotel.
Well, it's better to stay at the hotel where the conference is for several reasons. The meetings start early, they end late, they have all kind of conference and workshops, and they give you a better rate. And when you're talking about New York, one of the most expensive hotels in the country, in the world, New York and Washington, D.C., period.
So how do you, we come back. Let me finish with Tony. Tony Doris,
okay,
again, you spoke with the other council members. What have they said about their trips? How did they explain the expenditures?
Well, one of them is on the board, I think, of the National League of Cities or on a committee with them. Another is on the board of the Florida League of Cities. And they all say that these conferences are very educational, important things that they can learn and bring back. And you know what? They're not wrong in that. It's what I was looking at was a matter of balance. A city with not all that much extra money in its pockets, and they're sending four of them or two or three or whatever it is to the same conference with aides too, and cities paying for all of that. Whereas there are some cities, they'll send one person, he'll take notes and fill in the others on what he found and what he learned. But you're asking what their responses are. The responses are, well, there are so many sessions at these, so many different programs at these conferences that for one person to go, you'd miss 3/4 of the important material. So it's good to have other people along. That's the response I got.
Mayor Masters, you can understand when if people would say, look, we have a lot of problems in the city, and we watch you guys spending a lot of money on these trips and other expenditures and for personal reasons, like subscriptions to alumni, subscriptions. What do you say to the people in your city about the problems that they need fixed and how you guys are spending money?
Well, let me say, first of all, I've been in this seat for 5 terms. I think the people are pretty pleased with the work that I do as the mayor and will continue to do. And I only can speak for myself. In order to get the kind of technology that we have here, we have the spot shotter. Very few cities have it. We have a marina. Very few cities have it. We have a port. Very few cities have it. Very few cities have the redevelopment that is going on at the present time, like Riviera Beach. So I think if people understand that what we're trying to do is better our city, bring more technology in, take advantage of 1,500 people tourism in this city, and explore some of the possibilities that we can bring to help build our city, I think people will appreciate the fact. And that's basically where we lay our hat.
We're
second largest city in Palm Beach County, and we have our challenges, but we still want to bring the best to our city, best in technology, tourism, trade, whatever we can do.
Mayor, you also have...
We're not going to grow unless we leave the city. You can't do that in the city. You have to leave the city and leave the state and do these kinds of things.
I also wanted to point out to you, you also have one of the highest tax rates in the state.
Okay.
In the county. Excuse me, in the county. I mean, again, when you see all the problems that the city has, you have one of the highest tax rates in the county. Again, why aren't some of those problems being solved?
Well, let me just say this. First of all, the mayor doesn't vote. That's number one. Number two is that in addition to the trips, we're trying to do things to benefit our residents. We have job fairs. We have scholarships for the young people. We have all kinds of things that we do for our residents. Here in Riviera Beach that many cities are not doing for the residents. And that's just two of them. And we do it consistently and on a regular basis for the residents of Riviera Beach. For example, the mayor has a senior citizen discount where seniors over 62 years of age can go to 100 businesses in the city and get 10% to 50% discount on products and services. So we're always looking out for the benefit of our residents, and everything that I do is for the people, for the people, by the people, and of the people.
All right, I've got just a couple of minutes here. Tony Doris, the latest was that they are trying to hire a new city manager. There was a surprise back in October. There was a pitch for a gentleman to come in as the city manager, and I apologize, I'm going to pop up that name here in just a second. They proposed someone, and then that person had to drop out because there was some questions about their background.
And part of this is, they fired their city manager. They have no, assistant city manager. The police chief's resigning. There's a public works director that's out. They've got, so many of their top-level positions are empty. And so they finally have to pick someone on an interim basis to hurry up and fill in for the city manager who's leaving in a week and a half, or actually now it's a week. And they picked some name. Nobody knows how this
James A. Pogue. James A. Pogue was the name. And again, there was a question about background, and he dropped out.
For some reason, they just hired him. They hired him without an interview, without a background check. They said, let's hire him now. We'll do a background check as we make our way along. Well, it took the press less than 24 hours to see that this guy had a background that you wouldn't have hired if you'd only checked. And so it's kind of another symptom of the disarray in the city.
All right. Mayor Masters, I'm going to give you the last word. I mean, again, you're looking for, you got to fill these positions, as Tony Doris had mentioned. And again, there's a lawsuit against the city. And, you still have no answers as to why the last city manager was fired. All these different problems. What do you say to the people of Riviera Beach to instill any confidence in them that this government is working?
Well, I'll say that the best is yet to come. We're going to get through this. Like any other city, we have our challenges, we have our problems, but the best is yet to come. And I say to our council people, let's not rush as far as a city manager. Let's be methodical, strategical, and take our time and try to do a national search and get one of the best city managers that we can. And in the meantime, as we hire the interim manager who will be responsible for day-to-day operations. But Riviera Beach is not going anyway, going away. We're going to continue to build, grow, go, and glow, and continue to be one of the best waterfront cities in which to live, work, and play. And we have our problems. We try to fix it, and then we move on.
Thomas Masters is the mayor of Riviera Beach. Tony Doris, reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Gentlemen, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tony.
All right, coming up next, we're going to learn about a competition in Japan called Koishen and why every summer it captivates a nation. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, well, baseball season's over. Last night, the Houston Astros defeated the Los Angeles Dodgers for the World Series title, their first ever. Congratulations to the city of Houston. Now, what if I told you that there was a baseball tournament somewhere else in the world that got as much, if not more, attention than the World Series? What would you think if I told you that it was a high school baseball tournament? In Japan, there is a tournament called Koishen, and the final game is played in a packed stadium of more than 50,000 fans. That's a high school baseball game. There's a documentary film that is going to be playing, screened at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens tonight at 7 o'clock, that looks at this tournament. And we're joined now by the director, Kenneth Ang. Kenneth, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lewis. It's really good to be here.
You know what? Please help me with the title because, you know, look, I never studied or practiced Japanese, so I don't want to, you know, twist this up. But the title of the movie, how do you say this word?
Yeah, it's pronounced Kokoyaku. And the whole title of the film is Kokoyaku High School Baseball. And it literally means school baseball. So I wanted to juxtapose the English and the Japanese word together because essentially in Japan, baseball is something totally different. They've made it their own. They've instilled samurai wisdom into it and turned into a martial art. They use it as part of education. And it's very exciting. And it's definitely something to be seen.
I wondered with you, I mean, look, with your background, I mean, you're born here in the United States. You're an American citizen.
But, that's right.
You know, with your background, I was just wondering how that irony hit you. Baseball is America's pastime, and yet it is beloved intensely in Japan.
Yes, I mean, as a Chinese American, and a lover of baseball, I was really interested in the Japanese approach to baseball. And when we started this film, it was around 2001 when Ichiro and Matsui just came over. And one of my best friends, Alex Shear, / producer, he was reading this book called "You've Got to Have Wa" by Robert Whiting. And so there's not much information back then in English about the Japanese baseball experience. So there's a small chapter in that book about the high school tournament. And when we read it, Alex read it, we realized this is something that we had to make a film about.
This movie follows two different teams as they prepare for the opportunity to play in this tournament. It's a tournament of 49 different clubs, and they play for the summer title. How did you plan to tell the story in order to help anyone who doesn't live in Japan to really understand the gravity of this tournament and its hold on the culture?
Well, I mean, when you make a film like this, you can only draw parameters and hope for the best for the action to fall within those parameters. We were lucky enough that this tournament happens every year. So, and then you start out with 5,000 high schools, a little more than 5,000. And as the summer progresses, the teams get eliminated. If you lose once, it's all over. So we were really lucky because the High School Baseball Federation gave us a chance to work with a couple of schools that are sort of always going, and also some schools that were really that focused on education. And we started with four schools, but then we had to, because of logistics and budget, we cut out two schools. And fortunately, the experience is mostly of losing. So, you know, we didn't know if we were going to follow the winner, but at least we could learn something out of the experience of following these schools as a journey to the championship.
You know, if I'm not mistaken, by the way, I mean, one of these schools is a public school that you had followed,
yep,
and the other one was a private school.
Yes, that's right. From Tennoji High School from Osaka. It's one of the big schools that focuses on education. So a lot of the graduates from there go to really good colleges. So they're not really that good in baseball, but they've in the history of their school, they actually got to Koshin once. And as far as the school, the private school that we followed, Chiben Wakayama, they are this big powerhouse private school that goes to Koshin every year, basically, every other year. So we felt like we had a really good chance to get to the tournament.
You know, it seems from appearances, you know, in that sense, that it looked as though the private school just was better equipped, had the better athletes. And you see that here in this country. And they were, at the time, they were the defending champions. Is it a matter of haves and have-nots in the Japanese culture as well?
Yeah, I mean, for public schools in Japan, you have to stay within your district where you live. But for private schools, they're not limited to recruiting kids from all over Japan. So you're sort of at a disadvantage playing against the private schools. But that's why the baseball tournament, the amateur baseball there, is so amazingly exciting, because sometimes a public school will beat a private school. And when that happens, people are, you know, very, very happy, excited. And as the tournament progresses, there are a lot of underdogs that win. And we all know baseball can go either way. You know, you never know where the ball will bounce, so to speak. So,
no, absolutely. You said something really, really cool earlier. It's in the film. You talk about bringing this warrior mentality, you know, to baseball in Japan. There is a scene where the young men are practicing, and I had to do a double take. They weren't swinging bats at one point. They were swinging these wooden poles that looked like samurai swords.
Yes.
And this was part of practice?
Yep. At Tennoji High School, they actually use kendo sticks, and they train really early morning. And I think it's because of the movement of the wrist. It trains the way you hold the bat. And, you know, and I also think it's part of the martial arts there. They consider baseball as a martial art, not only to train the body, but also the mind and spirit. So, but I also really think it's because of how baseball was brought to Japan that it's part of education. In 1893, this guy Horace Wilson, a retired Civil War general, went to teach English at Ichiko, Tokyo University. And he noticed the future leaders of Japan looking pale and weak. So he decided to bring them all to the school grounds and to hit ground balls to them. So, you know, that's really how baseball was born, on the school grounds of Japan's most prestigious university. So it got more popular. So then Asahi Shimbun in 1915 started hosting the first tournament. So that's really how it started, the obsession. But a lot of schools, a lot of managers and coaches do things differently. But the schools that we followed, Masa Sensei really uses that technique, because he's a believer that baseball is martial art.
So we follow these two teams. We follow a couple of young players on both of those teams, and this, you know, this incredible routine, spending so much time practicing, trying to get on the team, and then, of course, get into the tournament. One of the fascinating scenes, I thought, was when they were picking the team. This was at the public school team.
Oh, yeah.
And they were in a – I looked like a classroom, and all these young men are sitting in there, and here come the coaches. And now they're going to, of course, you know, tell the players who's going to be on the team, and they hand out their numbers. And they mention a name. That guy comes up, picks up his number, and then he stands in front of the classroom – and talks to all of these young men, and he says something to them, and it could be anything, but that moment, I played Little League baseball. I've never seen anything like this. What does that moment signify? What's the symbolism of this?
Well, I mean, on these high school baseball teams, there can only be 18 players on the roster. So making the last spot is very, very important. And it's one of the things that these kids will remember most. And I just remember being in the room recording it. I was doing sound at the time, and just seeing it play out, and after translating it, it just totally moved me, because he was just telling everyone how thankful he was, and he'll try his best. And after he got his number, the coach, Masa Sensei, the teacher, he has him stand up and basically tells him how lucky he is, but and uses it as a teaching moment, because he's not the most talented, he's not the best baseball player, but he still felt the need to include him on the team. And I thought that was such an amazing telling moment in Japanese society. I mean, basically, in this film, I'm using baseball as a lens into looking into the Japanese spirit. you know, learning what Japanese society is like. So, and when we saw that unfold, it was just mind-blowing, just really moving. And, yeah, who says Japanese people are very unemotional, right?
I'll tell you what. I mean, we're going to take a quick break here, but I want to tell you that it wasn't the baseball so much as really getting this peek into this culture. And for me, the two things that seem to jump out the most are honor and respect. And this is, you know, it just was the theme throughout the film. But we're going to continue that conversation here in just a moment. Again, I'm talking with director Kenneth Ang. He has the film, the movie, Kokoyakyu High School Baseball. It's going to be screening at the Murakami Museum in Japanese Gardens tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll have more information on our website and more on this conversation coming up here on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined with director Kenneth Ang. His film is going to be screened tonight at the Murakami Museum in Japanese Gardens. It's tonight at 7 o'clock. It is a documentary about a baseball tournament called Koishen in Japan. This is a tournament that captivates a country. And the final scene in this film, you see the baseball game, the final championship game, played in a stadium with 50,000-plus fans. That's a high school game. The Los Angeles Dodgers don't average that in a game during the regular season, just to get a picture of what I'm talking about. You know what, Kenneth, so many things about this. Again, it wasn't about the baseball. It was about understanding another culture and how they do things. But let's get back to, you know, with this baseball team, once they pick the players, another thing I thought was fascinating is they have cheerleaders, but they have like a cheer section. And this is made up of the players who didn't make the team, I guess. And they take this seriously. Like, they practice yells and screams and cheers, and they are very synchronized. It is something that's really important. And listen, they have a leader, and when they don't cheer well enough or they don't really put their heart and soul into it, he really nails down on them.
Well, I mean, like, it's everyone that has to do with baseball in Japan, the high school baseball, no matter the parents, the cheer squad, the brass band, if they feel like if they do well, they can transfer that to the team on the field. So it's very intense, and they feel this connection. And, you know, they have these cheer clubs, these cheer squads. There's cheerleaders, but, you know, specifically the one you're talking about is the cheer boys,
yes,
which I've never seen. And it's sort of like this. They have this thing called the senpai kohai dynamic, which is the senior and juniors dynamic. So the seniors usually talk down, but they're teaching lessons. They're trying to bring the younger generation and get them up to speed and teach them what it means to cheer at Koshin. So, I mean, there's some hazing involved, but then, you know, that's part of the society over there. And, you know, it can be scary at times, the way he speaks to the cheer club. And, you know, there's funny parts, there's some emotional moments, but it's very telling about Japanese society, the way this dynamic is a part of the baseball culture there.
And I talked about respect. Really, the thing that I got from this film was the two things that seem to be so important in people's lives: honor and respect. That same cheering club, if your team loses, they will sit there and they will send a cheer to the other team and basically say, "We honor your great victory and wish you great victories forward." I mean, look, a lot of times, you know how it is here. Team loses, you know, you're cursing out the guys from the other teams. Like, they actually, you know, showed this incredible amount of respect for the team that just beat you.
Yeah, it's a sign of good sportsmanship. It's still a part of education. It's all about the manners that they try to convey to all the players, the young people. And it's as a Westerner, it's a beautiful thing to see and learn, because I think we can learn about ourselves by looking at different cultures in the world. So just seeing how they interpret baseball and instill this teaching moment, this kind of education. And I mean, these lessons that can be transferred on how to live life. And I just think it's very beautiful to see. And I think we can learn a lot from it.
You know, you talk about emotions, so many emotions in this movie, and I will not deny the fact that at times I was choked up and tearing up. There is one moment, powerful moment, when the coach is talking to the captain of his team. They had just lost. And these two men are crying. and the coach is saying some of the most. I'm thrown away, blown away, because I've never seen a coach talk like this to a player. He sits there and he talks to this his player, and he's just complimenting him.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's the coach right there. Yeah, that's the coach right there talking to his player, and he's saying things like, you know, you played so hard, and then really beyond that, he goes, call me when you get married, raise your kids, teach them baseball, you know, become a good man. I mean, it was a powerful moment. Powerful moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's when I realized that this tournament is not about results. It's not about being the champion. I mean, there only can be one team that can experience that, and to see this coach Masa Sensei speak to his captain like that, Captain Maeda. I mean, he's been trying to reach for the tournament, the championships for about 30 years, and he hasn't been there. But you know what becomes of this tournament? It's really about the process. You know, what can you teach these young people, these young men, as they move on to the next stage of their lives? You know, overcoming adversity, paying respects to the elders and everyone that's helped give you this chance to play the sport you love, and just be able to train your body and spirit. You know, it's really a preparation for the next stage in life, and it's such a transcendental moment, and it just helped me understand Japanese culture a lot more. And you know, I hope we can get something out of it, learn about ourselves, learn about humanity, where we need to get to. I mean, it's these little moments, you know.
What did you learn about the Japanese culture and the way they view baseball? Do they care about American baseball? Do they watch American baseball besides watching other Japanese players playing in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I mean, they know about the American style of baseball, but they also are very aware of their own style and the way they approach baseball. They love small ball. They love bunting. They respect speed. They love working together as a team. So there's like this team aspect, but there's also this face-to-face, you know, head-to-head matchup between the pitcher and batter. So there's these democratic values that they find amazing and worthwhile in baseball. You know, it's, you can be big and or short. You can be fat or skinny, you can still contribute. And I think it's just a very telling thing about the Japanese culture and society.
I do have to ask you this. I mean, an alum of the Koshien Games with a number of appearances there was very prominent in the World Series, Dodgers pitcher Yu Darvish.
Oh, yeah.
And there was an unfortunate reason, incident when the Astros, Yuli Gurriel, hit a home run.
Yep.
And then, of course, when he returned to the Astros dugout, he put his fingers to the sides of his face. He lifted the corners of his eyes. It was the slanted eyes gesture, which is regarded as a racist mockery of Asians. But, I mean, when you saw that, when you heard about that, I mean, what are you thinking at that point?
I was upset, you know, and also, I mean, I was... But also seeing Darvish in the World Series made me happy also, because we were over there making the film. It was 2004, and actually Darvish was in high school, and he was the talk of the country. He's just famous as a high school player there. But to see him turn that moment into a learning, teaching moment was, I thought, totally connected to Kokoyaku, totally connected to high school baseball there. You know, and I personally, I think hopefully we can learn from it. And, you know, it's just not cool to go there. You know, there's so much xenophobia and hatred in the world that it's just really counterproductive, you know. And that's a big reason why I make these films, is to, you know, deepen our understanding of each other. How do we have a deeper understanding and more compassion? And how do we learn empathy for one another? You know, how do we connect our similarities? How do we, you know, spot the differences but respect them? So, you know, documentary for me is all about building this compassion, and how to use it as an educational tool. So, you know, hopefully we can learn from it. And, you know, they won the World Series. I'm happy for Mr. Gurriel. So, you know, hopefully he learned from it. But I say, let's move on. You know, we have a lot of work to do in this world, not only this country. So
the film is called Kokoyaku High School Baseball. It is screening at the Murakami Museum in Japanese Gardens tonight at 7:00. A beautiful film. Kenneth Ang, the director. It was such a pleasure to watch it, and really a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. We've got tickets left, so come on down. It's beautiful there.
All right. And again, if you're not a baseball fan, it's all right. A beautiful movie beyond that. So, all right. Well, coming up next, we're going to take a closer look at how Boca Raton played a role in winning World War II. Yeah, that's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, one of the most important tools invented and used to help the Allies win World War II was the radar, specifically radar using microwaves. And that technology was developed right here in South Florida in the 1940s in Boca Raton. The story of that invention will be told in a new WLRN TV documentary called Boca Raton, the Secret Weapon That Won World War II. It debuts at 8 p.m. next Monday, November 6th. We're joined now by Susan Gillis, who's the curator at the Boca Raton Historical Society Museum and one of the narrators in this documentary. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, I have to admit, I was a history major before I got into this business in college. I thought I was going to be a professor. Loved my history, especially World War II history. I did not know a lot of things. This is one of them. The soldiers and scientists that worked on the radar in Boca Raton carried that secret for decades. How did it eventually get out? How did we learn about it?
Well, we all grew up with knowing what radar is and the present generation and so on. But yes, indeed, the instructors at the base were mum about this. They were sworn to secrecy during the war. Radar was not a word you could say out loud. It was a court-martialable offense to use the word radar. They often use the word radio to allude to it. And I know many children of veterans who have told me, hey, my dad never told me what he did. They continue to carry that secret. And it just eventually we realize, no, that's no longer secret technology. And as early as, say, 46, 47, I know there were books published about the Boca Raton field, and the term was freely used. It was no longer a secret.
All right. So basically, scientists, the military, they're working on this new technology because what's happening at this point is that the German U-boats, basically the German Navy, has really just dominated in the early part of the war in the Atlantic because of the submarines, the U-boats. And we had no technology in finding them and stopping them. But now you have this group of scientists and researchers and the military at MIT working on this technology. They couldn't stay up there. Eventually, they needed to find a new location. How in the world did they find Boca Raton?
Well, Boca Raton was the Army Air Corps' only wartime radar training base for airborne radar. There were other types of radar training bases all around us. For example, the Signal Corps trained in radar there at Jonathan Dickinson State Park. But in order to really do adequate training, they need better climate, close to shipping lanes, where there was plenty of wide open space. And Boca Raton was one of those places back in the 40s. There weren't a lot of people here. There was plenty of real estate. It was just as today, close to other cities and good transportation hubs, but it was right on the ocean and so on for training purposes.
All right. How do you describe what Boca Raton was in the early 1940s?
Well, incredibly different from today when we have about 200,000 residents. Back then there were 750, and my friends who lived here then say they think that's an exaggeration. A little farming town with a big fancy resort known as the Boca Raton Club. Today it's the resort and club. And two stoplights. I'd like everyone to know there wasn't just one. There were two stoplights in town. But a very, very small town indeed, with two bars, of course, but no grocery store to speak of.
Two bars and two stoplights. That is an interesting picture of Boca Raton back then. So the Army decides this is the perfect place. This is the perfect place to set up a camp, to set up a base, to work on this new technology, this new radar technology. And then all of a sudden, all these soldiers come, and the city actually comes to life, because you're talking about thousands and thousands of people come down here. They build a base. They basically build the city.
That's right. It became the mainstay of the economy. It was an incredible boon to not only Boca, but all our sister cities around us, because people servicemen were housed on the base, but a lot of them had their families in tow. There were a lot of civilian employees. They had to live somewhere. And we have maps that show where to live as far north as Boynton Beach, as far south as Fort Lauderdale. So, yes, it was very, very vital to the economy during that era.
Something that was really interesting from the film, and again, I have to admit that even as a history major, I did not know this, that the battle, really, World War II came right here to our doorstep, that U-boats were really off the coast destroying ships. That, as pointed out in the film, there were bodies from these ships that were washing up on the shore here in South Florida.
I think most people, I myself was not taught this in school, have no idea how close the U-boats came to our very Florida shores. We have a number of eyewitnesses to that event. There were supposedly 42 merchant ships sunk between about Cape Canaveral and Fort Lauderdale in the summer of 42. And often there were bodies, but a lot of flotsam from the ships, the merchant ships, would float ashore. And we actually, in our collections at the Historical Society, have a Maxwell House coffee can that has clearly been to the bottom of the ocean. It has never been opened. And, of course, it is good to the last drop.
I'm sure the company appreciates that one.
That's a little plug.
There you go. So, you know, eventually, I mean, the scientists are working at breakneck speed because they're trying to develop this technology. And again, the tricky part with radar back then is that it just wasn't good at picking up small items in the water, because with these U-boats, a lot of times they're underwater. But they eventually get to that point and they put that technology in planes, and that starts to turn the tide of the war. Once the war is over, then the base is no longer needed. The secret's still kept for a while, but now everybody kind of leaves. And yet it was shortly after that there was a boom. What really happened after the war, once it all came to an end? What happened to Boca Raton?
Well, interestingly enough, the base was still very active until 47, and not nearly as many men's stationed here, but there still were still very active base, and apparently there was some talk of making a full-time military base and continuing on. But in 1947, there were two major storms, one in September that was a Category 4, and there were about 800 buildings on the base. Many of them were just tar paper shacks. They were camp buildings. They came down like dominoes. And so that just effectively squelched the idea that that was going to be a permanent base, and the move to Keyserville began then. However, there was still an auxiliary Air Force base, because at that time, by then, by 47, the Air Corps had become the U.S. Air Force. There was still a small auxiliary Air Force base located on what is now FAU and airport grounds until the about 1960, I believe.
You know what? Let me finish with this. In the movie, you did speak to some folks who actually were there. And I wondered if, have we done enough to get the stories from that generation? Because we're losing that generation very quickly.
We certainly are. And it delights me to still meet often 95-year-olds who have a great memory and come by and visit me unsolicited and say, you know, I was stationed here. It's just amazing. And so they are out there. We try to document. I've interviewed a number of these folks myself, and make a record if they have photographs and documents to share with us. That is something we collect at the Historical Society and try and preserve for the future generations.
Susan Gillis is the curator at the Boca Raton Historical Society and Museum. She's also in the new documentary that WLRN-TV is going to be airing next week. It's called Boca Raton, The Secret Weapon That Won World War II. Again, it debuts Monday, November 6th at 8 p.m. Susan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And that is the end of the program. Another great week. Thank you so much for listening. You can always share your thoughts. Let us know what you think of the program or anything that we could be doing better. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN Sundial. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.